Our next panel, I think, is going to be equally wonderful. I'm happy to welcome John Jackson, who is the president of William Jessup University. He has served as the president of that university since 2011 and has been an empire builder, in a sense. I don't know if he appreciates that description, but has taken a small university and turned it into one that is thriving and dynamic. And I think in large measure by focusing on mission and deciding this is who we are going to be and being the best at what they hope to be rather than trying to be something that everyone else is. Next, we'll hear from Patrick Riley, the president of the Cardinal Newman Society. I'm really happy to meet Patrick and to welcome him. Cardinal Newman changed my life. I was a business student at Georgetown University, and Father Timothy S. Healy, S.J., the president of the university, took me under his wing and became my mentor and told me that I was wasting my time in the business school. And he handed me a copy of Cardinal Newman's magnum opus, The Idea of a University. And it was his dog-eared copy. He told me to read it and come back and talk to him. And it made a big difference in my life. The Newman Society promotes and defends faithful Catholic education and has been a champion of religious freedom for religious educators. Mr. Riley has authored numerous reports and studies on Catholic education, written articles on Catholic education and other issues for many national publications. I think he also is someone who believes in being distinctive and having a voice and being true to that voice. And we look forward to hearing from him. Our next speaker will then be Shapreet D. Limoglio, the Vice President for Government Relations and Executive Programs of the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. She leads the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities' response to legislative, legal, and regulatory matters on behalf of its 180 institutions of Christ-centered higher education. At a time when religious education around the world, and certainly in the United States, is under a tremendous amount of pressure to conform to secular norms, she is well positioned to help us understand these issues, and someone who is really helping create space for distinctive and unique religious voices. Our final speaker on this panel will then be Kent Hill, the executive director of the Religious Freedom Institute. The Religious Freedom Institute, he joined in...
I'm somebody else, but I'll...
Oh, yeah, I apologize. Sorry, I got my signals crossed. I apologize for that. Steve Sandberg, I apologize, Steve, is the Deputy General Counsel of Brigham Young University, joining that office in 2006, a graduate of BYU with a JD from Columbia Law School, where he was a Harlan Fiske Scholar. He clerked on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and practiced law at Morrison and Forrester before joining the BYU Office of General Counsel. So let's proceed in that order. We've asked each of our speakers to speak for about 20 minutes, and then we'll open the floor for questions and answers.
Thank you so much. I'm just in hope and expectation that the clock does not stop because I'm watching it to make sure I keep faithful to my time. I want you to know I've been here for a few days and I've experienced tremendous hospitality. The hospitality is definitely at an A-plus level. I have also figured out the timing of this conference between July 4th and Pioneer Day. This is the fireworks that keeps on going. So it's a tremendous experience. And I want to thank the organizers of the conference as well. I'm quite concerned about Dr. Williams in particular, in that she set the bar so high with her singing. I want to make a solemn oath that I will not be singing this morning. My father used to say that when I sang the national anthem, people moved to Canada. So it is my gift to you to not sing this morning. I was deeply touched by the first session, and I also want to thank the organizers of the conference for allowing for some personal reflections on religious freedom. Religious freedom is, after all, not fundamentally an academic or a legal or constitutional exercise. It is something that is profoundly personal and individual. I want to thank you profusely for the opportunity and the privilege to speak here at this timely conference. I want you to know just a bit about me. I'm a trained and experienced pastor and organizational leader, but I'm a thoroughly amateur historian, economist, and constitutional attorney. With that delimiter, I have two quotes I'd like to share with you. One from John Adams. You've heard a little bit about it so far. John Adams says this: "We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Avarice, ambition, revenge, or gallantry would break the strongest cords of our Constitution as a shale goes through a net. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other." And then a second quote, the French diplomat and historian Alexis de Tocqueville, about 1848, said the following: "The Americans combine the notion of religion and liberty so intimately in their minds that it is impossible to make them conceive of one without the other." Morality, religion, liberty, and constitutional law. These are the forces in some measure of tension and heightened conflict in our day. I was intrigued recently by a video at Prager University, these short little snippets. It was a fantastic little video on whether or not America was founded to be a secular republic or a religious republic. I think your answer to that question determines in some measure where you might stand on issues of religious freedom. During this particular session, our focus is more specifically on religious liberty and faith-based higher education. As many of you know, the history of the earliest education in America begins with the religious institutions. If I recall correctly, all but one of what we now know as the Ivy League schools began by religious groups, fundamentally for the training of ministers of the gospel. Over time, many of those schools became more secularized, even while remaining private. Public colleges were soon developed by states with a particular eye towards specializations that were important for the developing nation. Schools training business, agriculture, education, medicine, liberal arts, and the arts have long been a part of the mix. Today in California, where I reside, and I know that's a curiosity for some in the room, but today in California, accredited private higher education educates about 20% of the undergraduate population and about 55% of the graduate population of students in the state. The university I'm privileged to serve, William Jessup University, was founded in 1939 as San Jose Bible College, and we changed our name to honor our founder upon our move to the Sacramento region in 2004. We're a Christ-centered university. We affirm biblical authority and the unity of the church. We have approximately 50 denominations present on our campus. All employees have a community covenant, and a student handbook exists for all students. We have a statement of faith. Our community covenant contains explicit language regarding beliefs, behaviors, and community standards. We're committed to transformation, to scholarship, to innovation, and flourishing. And I will say my wife and I were privileged to tour the BYU campus just two short days ago, and we're literally astounded at the excellence, the beauty, and the commitment to integrity we found across the campus. So if at nothing else, your tour guides are exceedingly well-trained. Now, I know that one of the issues you might want to hear about today is how a school of our type can respond to the seemingly ever-changing culture in California and on the national scene, and to particular challenges with religious liberty in a pluralistic environment. I suppose if one wanted to define pluralism, one might look to California as an example, or at least a petri dish of sorts. Well, I want to provide a broad overview with general themes and then a specific application with a recent California state legislative matter that some of you will know about. I'll conclude with brief remarks regarding what some have called fairness for all, roughly at the national level, modeled on legislation you have here in Utah. Some know it as, quote, the Utah Compromise, and I understand some are not fond of that term, but that's a term in the popular literature. I suspect many of you in this room will be perhaps supportive of a fairness for all, so I think you'll enjoy my comments. My view of many of these matters has to do with some constitutional parameters and from my understanding of the Bible. I'm so thankful that I can use a scripture in this setting. There are some settings I'm in where that's not welcome, but I'd like to share with you a basic biblical framework. In our particular university, our biblical and Orthodox Christian mission includes the teaching of creation, of human sexuality, as reflected in the communal nature of God himself through the relationship of Father, Son, and Spirit. In Genesis 1, 26 to 27, in the first pages of scripture, it says, "Let us create humankind in our image. And therefore God created humankind in his image, male and female, he created them." As we understand scripture, the male-female gender duality of human sexuality is at the very heart of the human race's identity as carriers of the image of God. According to the creation account, the purpose of marriage is to express and protect the nature of that male-female duality within the unified covenant relationship of marriage. It's how God expresses his commitment to his creation's life, its law, and ultimate plan of salvation. Now remember, I'm an amateur attorney. Regarding the Constitution, I offer the following. First of all, the Supremacy Clause, that's Article 6, Clause 2, says that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. And there are three amendments that I see as having intersection in our present era. The First Amendment, which guarantees freedoms of religion and speech and press and assembly. The 14th Amendment, which provides some due process protections and therefore a presumed right to privacy. And the 10th Amendment, which reserves powers to the states that are not specifically enumerated as belonging to the federal government. Each of those intersecting amendments will continue, in my view, to be part of the national conversation about religious, personal, and sexual freedom concerns in the days and years ahead. My hope is that the tone of these conversations nationally and in each of the states could be like the ones that we're having here today, that they could be respectful of personal, religious, and social convictions in our increasingly pluralistic society. Now, recent court cases may suggest a more deferential tone towards religious liberty and First Amendment cases than has been thought likely in previous eras. Should that occur, I will certainly celebrate the seeming change in direction and tone. And now in turn to a recent set of events in California. California, as some of you may know, is a slightly more, quote, blue state than Utah. If you don't know, the legislative composition in California is roughly the exact opposite in California of what it is in Utah. So if you rest comfortably here in Utah, you only need to look west to see what may be coming your direction. SB 1146, as originally proposed last year in California's legislative session, would have dramatically and negatively impacted California faith-based schools. It would have established an adversarial framework in which faith-motivated schools seeking to live out their convictions on sexuality and gender might have prevented having students who choose to attend their accredited schools from accessing scholarships under the Cal Grant program. Now, Cal Grant is our state-based program whereby we provide educational assistance to worthy students attending accredited institutions. In my view, and in the view of others, this was an egregious affront to religious liberty in that it would have effectively established a religious test for a generally available public benefit. I was privileged to have the opportunity to make some comments to the California legislature. And in that context, I said these words. This was a section of my statement. Part of the beauty of the American experience is the foundational recognition of inalienable rights, which do not derive from government, but derive from our Creator. Jessup and other faith-based schools have clear religious convictions regarding gender, sexuality, and marriage. Those convictions extend to all who attend our school and all who are employed by our school. SB 1146, the proposed legislation, marginalizes students and schools whose beliefs do not align with the views of those holding the levers of government power, creating a society that does not tolerate diversity of opinion, and even punishing dissent from what politicians have determined are the, quote, correct beliefs. SB 1146 restricts freedom of choice It limits the opportunities in education by forcing many first-generation college students and many students of color who would be unable to pursue higher education without a Cal Grant. It forces them to choose between attending a school that they have chosen based on their convictions or another option that doesn't fit their unique needs. Now, thankfully, in what at the time was a relatively rare victory for religious liberty, thankfully, that bill was dramatically altered because of our opposition. And it became a reporting bill rather than a restrictive bill. So we do now in California have to report some specific things, but we were not restricted in the ability to receive students with a Cal Grant. I will tell you, the bill passed because of the opposition of the religious community, but we were joined in that opposition by another group. It was a surprise to us. Another group opposed the legislation, and that was a four-letter word, the ACLU. The ACLU opposed the legislation as originally written because it didn't go far enough. So we don't rest very comfortably in the fact that we were able to prevail on this particular bill. Thus far, this current legislative session has been relatively quiet, except there's been a dramatic shift, even in the last day or two, for the legislature to go after employment law in California and provide no religious exemption. Not for religious associations, not for religious institutions, and not for house of worship. As written, there are three bills pending in the California legislature that attempt to essentially uphold a version of California employment law as currently written with religious exemptions and strip those current laws of any religious exemption. Now, in light of our California experience, it might seem that I personally and our school corporately would run into the arms of a proposed fairness for all national legislative approach, correct? I referenced the 10th Amendment. I referenced the First Amendment. I referenced the 14th Amendment and the intersection between those. It would seem like if we could get a national fairness for all legislation, perhaps that would be the answer that would resolve these tensions and keep us from the culture war that many of us are concerned about. It would seem that way, but I remain very dubious. Remember I said this was the fireworks in between July 4th and Pioneer Day? Well, get ready. I remain very dubious. I've not seen the proposed legislation. I've not seen an indication of potential sponsorship. And I have grave concerns about our experience in California that is roughly mirrored in Massachusetts and Illinois and other states. Now, I realize that many, including my dear friends in this room, and I want you to hear that with great sincerity, my dear friends in this room, I realize that many intend to press for this legislation, as far as I know, yet unwritten and unsponsored, that will seek to provide a host of religious liberty protections while simultaneously enshrining into federal law a variety of civil liberty protections for those in the LGBTQ community and for other sexual minorities yet to be determined. Let me be clear that I cast no aspersions on the motives of those who've pursued these policy aims with focus and force these past several months. But as a higher education leader in California, I live daily with the tension that these issues present for our state's lawmakers, our university's faculty and staff, and our students. I know firsthand the inevitable pain that comes from a lack of clarity around these issues. But even so, and particularly because so, I'm unwilling and I'm unable to support any legislation that normalizes gender fluidity or gender inconsequentiality or that normalizes same-sex sexual behavior. Now, please know that I'm unequivocally for civil protections for all persons in our constitutional republic, regardless of status or standing. Simultaneously, I'm biblically, theologically, parentally, and pastorally unable and unwilling to affirm any view of gender which suggests that maleness or femaleness are arbitrary, self-selected, fluid, or inconsequential. I'm likewise unable to affirm public policy which seeks to codify a host of variant sexual practices as normative for our republic, particularly when it does so while taking direct aim at the religious values and liberties that so many members of our community cherish and rely on our institutions to protect and uphold. My convictions compel me, for the sake of those whom I have responsibility to lead, not to appease or accommodate what Scripture clearly forbids. Got really quiet in the room. Now, I want to say very clearly, we may now, as our previous speaker indicated, we may now, or in the future, be living in exile. And if so, we will seek to be faithful to the gospel of Jesus Christ in exile. It's happened before. It's happening now around the planet. We know the narrative of the people of God living in exile. But I just can't be party to voluntarily writing laws that facilitate an exilic life in violation of my religious convictions. Now, what I didn't say at the beginning is that I have really strong Baptist background. I was born and reared in Baptist background. I have deep and abiding gratitude for my Baptist heritage. My more recent past 20 plus years has been in a interdenominational setting. I have deep appreciation and can lead an institution with 50 denominations because I think I have a deep commitment to John 17 and the unity of the church. I also have recently had occasion to develop friendships with a number of LDS leaders in our community. That has been a source of rich encouragement to me. I appreciate so deeply both our fellowship and our shared convictions about religious freedom. Those of you with LDS background know that it is an essential and inherent part of your heritage and your story. So I want to say to you that I recently had occasion, due to the kindness of my friend, Stake President Ned Telford, to review the remarks of Elder Oaks on religious freedom made in Dallas. I found those remarks refreshing and a helpful guide in principle, and I commend them to you. Again, those were the remarks of Elder Oaks in Dallas on religious liberty. I thought they were excellent and provide a very healthy framework in principle. I want to thank you for your time and attention today. I want to thank you for your kindness, and I want to thank in advance my fellow panelists that while we may disagree on some specific tactical approaches, at the end of the day, our ultimate goal is religious freedom for all. Thank you so much.
Okay, good afternoon. I can say that because I'm from DC, so it's afternoon. Like John, I'm a bit of an anomaly among the speakers at this conference. I'm not an academic and I am not an attorney, although I must say that over the last 10 years, I really do feel that I deserve a law degree for the amount of work we've had to do in just trying to understand and grasp all of these religious freedom threats that have come down. Mostly from the Obama administration, but much of it actually starting even before then. My work at the Cardinal Newman Society for almost the last 25 years has been focused on promoting strong religious identity at Catholic schools and colleges. There are about 200 Catholic colleges and universities in the United States, 1,200 Catholic high schools, and 5,200 Catholic elementary and secondary schools, which is about half of what it was 50 years ago. So there's a real crisis of finances, of theology, of dissent within the Catholic Church. There are a number of issues that we're wrestling with all at the same time, and then along comes the government pushing these threats to our religious freedom, and I'll get to this a little bit later, but in some ways it's actually been very good for the Church. So you could say that I come at these issues a little bit more from a religious and educational perspective than I do from a legal perspective. Over the past decade, many organizations, policymakers, and legal experts have fought crucial battles in legislatures and in the courts to defend the religious freedom of colleges and schools throughout the United States. And I applaud these efforts. We rely on these efforts. They are extremely important, and we've seen that they've had many successes, which is absolutely wonderful and crucial to the survival of religious institutions. At the Newman Society, we take a different approach to the issue. Our focus is on helping Catholic schools and colleges protect their mission by instituting policies that strengthen their religious identity and are more clearly tied to their Catholic beliefs. We think that this approach is extremely important, and so that's what I would like to talk about briefly today. Ultimately, religious freedom ensures that people can pursue freely and proclaim truth about God. It's about truth. It's a deep human need that precedes any law or any society. Recognizing that there are various but sincere claims about God, religious freedom acknowledges that people must be allowed without undue interference to follow their beliefs. Religious freedom then is tied closely to the mission of the university, which is to seek and to teach truth. In 1990, Pope St. John Paul II wrote the Catholic Church's Constitution on Higher Education called Ex Corde Ecclesiae, which in Latin means from the heart of the church. And the reason he titled that is because the very first modern universities were directly tied to the church. They were either financially supported and otherwise supported by the church, or actually directly affiliated with the church, and have been for most of the history of the university. He wrote, and I'm going to read a portion of that, but I'm going to substitute religious university for Catholic university because I think it applies generally to all religious institutions. It is the honor and the responsibility of a religious university to consecrate itself without reserve to the cause of truth. This is its way of serving at one and the same time both the dignity of man and the good of the church, which has an intimate conviction that truth is its real ally, and that knowledge and reason are sure ministers to faith. Without in any way neglecting the acquisition of useful knowledge, a religious university is distinguished by its free search for the whole truth about nature, man, and God. The present age is in urgent need of this kind of disinterested service, namely of proclaiming the meaning of truth, that fundamental value without which freedom, justice, and human dignity are extinguished. By means of a kind of universal humanism, a religious university is completely dedicated to the research of all aspects of truth and their essential connection with the supreme truth, who is God. It does this without fear, but rather with enthusiasm, dedicating itself to every path of knowledge, aware of being preceded by him who is the way, the truth, and the life, the Logos, whose spirit of intelligence and love enables the human person with his or her own intelligence to find the ultimate reality of which he is the source and end, and who alone is capable of giving fully that wisdom without which the future of the world would be in danger. That's the end of a very long quote. The patron of the Cardinal Newman Society, John Henry Newman, argued in his Idea of a University that no institution that excludes the science of theology and the implications of religious truth for other disciplines deserves the name university. He argued that only a religious university is a true university. I think this says all that needs to be said about the great value of religious higher education in America. Of course, there are many other benefits, including the impact of the graduates who go on into their fields with more than career skills, but also a formation of the human person, a commitment to ethics and strong virtue. Our graduates are key, especially today, to solving many of the problems that are confronting the church and that are arising from our secular culture. Nevertheless, despite their great value, religious colleges and universities today face serious threats to their mission to teach and witness to the truth. To some extent, it's been a long time in coming. Newman in 1873 predicted what he called an age of infidelity, a quote, darkness different in kind from any that has been before it, because while the church has been confronted by dissent and different beliefs, now we must confront a world that rejects religion altogether. In our present time, religious educators have endured a decade of violations from the federal government, which has attempted to impose restrictions and penalties on religious schools and colleges because of their traditional beliefs about gender, marriage, and sexuality. The new administration has provided some respite from these violations of religious freedom, but many threats continue, like the Education Department's interpretation of gender under Title IX. Meanwhile, the rights of religious educators to remain faithful to their beliefs are increasingly threatened in many states. Some, like California and New York, are attempting to force religious institutions to accept abortion coverage and employee health plans. We also have reason to fear challenges to in accreditation, in academic associations, in athletic leagues that may prevent the participation of religious colleges, restrict access to aid programs, and marginalize our institutions. The NCAA's gender policies are already creating difficulty for many of our colleges. Despite all this, what concerns me most are the threats from within our religious institutions. The lawsuits that are filed by students and employees demanding that colleges change their moral standards for employment, employee benefits, and student behavior. At Catholic schools and colleges, we have tracked an increasing number of such lawsuits over the past decade, and we expect that the trend will swing sharply upward very soon, given the direction of our culture. The best protection against such lawsuits for religious colleges and universities is to institute clear and consistent policies rooted in their religious beliefs. This is an essential but perhaps underutilized strategy at many institutions to protect the mission of religious education. Too often we look to the courts for relief without first preparing. Legal experts have repeatedly assured us that when religious colleges comply with internal policies that are clearly presented and rooted strongly in their religious beliefs, First Amendment protections are likely to prevail. But when educators lack consistent policies tied to their religious mission, the courts, policymakers, and the general public, especially in our secular culture, are likely to conclude that an institution's actions are arbitrary and discriminatory. Religious colleges and universities should consider policies that address all aspects of higher education, including employee contracts, handbooks, and other policies related to employee hiring, retention, discipline, and firing, moral and behavioral expectations for employees and students, course and curricular guidelines, guidelines for prayer services and other religious activities, guidelines for student athletics and activities, use of campus facilities by employees, by students and unrelated organizations coming onto campus, including guidelines for chapels. We've come across a number of Catholic colleges and universities that simply have no protection if somebody wanted to rent out the chapel to celebrate a same-sex wedding within the chapel. And then finally, guidelines for residence halls and privacy concerns at residential colleges. Without these, religious institutions are vulnerable to lawsuits, and in our current culture, are likely to lose. Therefore, every religious school or college needs to prepare for lawsuits and alleged violations of religious freedom in the coming years, and perhaps in the coming months. However, from what I've seen of Catholic education and some other religious institutions, as I said, many of them are wholly unprepared. Our experience is that most Catholic colleges and universities, including many of the most faithfully religious institutions, lack adequate policies to articulate and protect their religious mission. And as I've said, my experience, limited as it is, with other institutions is that many suffer from the same lack of adequate policies. Instead, these institutions rely on vague references to their religious identity and handle disputes on a case-by-case basis. But the lack of adequate policies puts institutions in grave danger. Not only may educators be helpless to defend their rights against government coercion, but they also invite discrimination claims and lawsuits. Without preparation, they're highly vulnerable to these threats. I'll give you three examples, recent examples of lawsuits that were filed against Catholic schools. This is at the elementary and secondary level, by their own employees. In California, an employee filed a lawsuit claiming that he was, quote, shocked and unprepared for the school's disciplinary action following his public and persistent violation of Catholic values. In Georgia, an employee filed a lawsuit claiming school leaders had been aware of his poor moral example long before he was fired, and the faculty handbook did not require him to uphold Catholic teaching. In New Jersey, an employee has filed a lawsuit complaining of a double standard. Other employees were exhibiting worse moral behavior, according to him, including one who shared nude photographs online, but the school's responses were inconsistent in those cases. In each of these cases, the reason for disciplinary action was clear and unsurprising and appropriate for a religious institution. An educator's witness to their religious beliefs in both word and deed should be expected at any religious school or college. But the employees who filed the lawsuits were allegedly, at least according to their own testimony, unclear about such expectations and therefore have claimed discrimination and probably have a strong case. There's an additional concern. Unpreparedness leads to fear. Religious educators who are unprepared for threats to their mission feel backed into a corner with no good choice. Either they mount a weak court defense or they compromise their religious identity. Religious college and university leaders are rightly afraid of growing reprisals and restrictions. The potential consequences of losing in court include lawsuit damages, loss of student aid, loss of government contracts, inability to participate in sporting leagues, loss of accreditation, ineligibility to grant diplomas or degrees, and exclusion from professional associations. In a word, these institutions will be labeled discriminatory. Unprepared colleges have already been the first to buckle under pressure and compromise and to compromise their own identity. We have seen this in the face of threats from the Obama administration. Many Catholic colleges chose voluntarily to comply with the contraceptive coverage mandate in employee health plans, while others were fighting it in court. One prominent institution fought it in court and compromised at the exact same time. But we also need to be very aware of the pressure to secularize that religious colleges have felt since the 19th century. As John mentioned, there's been a history of this, and Father James Burchell's outstanding history of religious higher education titled The Dying of the Light, he shows how many leading universities, Harvard, Princeton, Dartmouth, and more recently, universities like the University of Notre Dame, are shifting to a more secular model. Today, the threats to religious freedom are serious, and what has been a trickle will soon become a downpour. I don't think that the Trump administration is providing any more than a very short respite. Our religious colleges and universities need protection, defending, and equipping now more than ever. So in conclusion, my argument, I want to add one other point here with regard to the hypocrisy of these institutions, which is really what this is, even if not always intended. When a religious university compromises for its own sake, faced with these religious liberty threats, it makes it all the more difficult for other religious institutions to defend their religious freedom. Certainly in terms of the public opinion and the public support for religious institutions, it declines every time one of our institutions is declared discriminatory by a court, and every time it's clear to even those that are not part of our religious faith that these religious institutions are claiming and fighting for religious freedom in the courts, even though they clearly act in different ways within their own day-to-day activities. So this hypocrisy is not only dangerous to the particular institutions that are practicing it, but it's dangerous to all of us. So in conclusion, my argument is that a religious college or university's mission is best protected by strengthening it, not compromising it. An institution that is authentically, consistently religious has the most compelling claim to its religious heritage and First Amendment protections. Alarmingly, however, the policies and practices of many religious colleges and universities are vague and inconsistent. This will lead to lawsuits, weak legal defenses, and the proclivity to buckle under pressure. For religious education, the clearest presentation and most consistent implementation of an institution's policies that are explicitly tied to the particular religious beliefs of the institution is the best legal defense against threats to religious freedom from both inside and outside the institution. By contrast, bland conformity to the dictates of secularism will not protect America's diverse religious institutions, but will destroy their diversity, their freedom, and their fidelity. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me here today. It's a real honor to be here. I'm so grateful to the organizers of the conference for inviting the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities to be represented. We have had the really distinct privilege of, over the years, increasingly being able to work with BYU and the LDS Church on matters of religious liberty. And it has been such a vital part of the work that we do. I think we are all increasingly seeing that it is not going to be possible to protect religious freedom in our society if we do not work together collaboratively on it across religious traditions. And so it has been encouraging to see the religious diversity present at this conference, which I believe is evidence of the direction that we all, I think, recognize that we continue to need to move in. As Brett referenced at the beginning, the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities is an organization, an association actually. We're located in the Capitol Hill neighborhood of Washington, D.C., and we represent 180 Christ-centered institutions across 35 states and 20 countries around the world. About 145 are here in the United States, and it is a privilege to represent them. One of the distinctives of the institutions that are full members of our organization is that they hire only Christians for all of their full-time faculty and administrative positions. And so the kinds of protections that have been referenced thus far today and the kinds of threats that have been referenced thus far today, we are squarely in the center of those challenges and conversations. Right now, in this moment in history, LGBT rights and religious rights is the particular moment in clash. But we know, of course, that just generally hiring rights and the ability to hire based on religion is a right that we have and that we do not take for granted. And it's really essential to the character of the institutions that I have the privilege of representing. And so I'm gonna take a little bit different tact to my, I have the privilege of being here at the 41st minute of you all listening. So I'm gonna try to mix it up a little bit here. Talk about some tactical, legal, legislative things that we're pursuing in Washington, D.C. I was going to talk about those first. I'm going to talk about those second. I'm going to start with something that I think is a little bit different and hopefully will catch your ear. Have you heard of Jonathan Haidt? He's a sociologist. He's a professor at the University of Virginia and now at NYU. He wrote a book about a little over 10 years ago called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. If you haven't read this book, I would commend it to you. And if you want the cliff notes, you can watch a really great TED talk that he does on it. That in 20 minutes will give you a good summation of the arguments. But I think it's a really important pivotal book because I think it helps bridge the gap in a lot of just misunderstanding that we have going in our culture right now. When I started the position I have now, I was not yet 30. I was just on the cusp of it. And I was an anomaly among my peers. And even knowing what religious liberty was and caring about it and talking about it was very strange. And I think that when we look at religious liberty, I'm going to argue that if we don't take some different legal tax, yes, but public relations tax, we're not going to make it. So ultimately, the law follows culture. And so the question is, can we free religious liberty from the culture wars? I think that if we can't do that, if we can't take some different tax, as I said, I think we're going to be unsuccessful long-term at preserving religious freedom as we know it today in the United States. I think we have long talked about religious liberty with dogmatic speech, outraged posture, and aggressive demeanors. And we've used circular logic to defend it. Well, you should support religious liberty because religious liberty is in the First Amendment. And because the First Amendment says we have religious liberty, therefore we should protect religious liberty. And we go round and round that circle. And if that doesn't resonate with you, how do we get out of that circle into some other ways of thinking? And I think Jonathan Haidt offers a helpful paradigm. He has a theory that he references and calls the moral foundations theory. And he says there are six moral foundations that essentially you can categorize the kind of that all people hold. Number one, care harm. Number two, fairness cheating. Number three, loyalty betrayal. Number four, authority and submission. Number five, sanctity or degradation. And number six, liberty or oppression. And what he says is that if you look at the difference, again, the title of the book, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion, he says if you look at how people that tend to gravitate towards one political party or the other function and why they gravitate towards one political party or the other, he says people who are conservative and especially religious conservatives tend to hold all six of these in approximately equal measure. But he says that people that gravitate towards a more liberal political ideology or theory tend to elevate care harm, fairness cheating, and liberty oppression above the other three. And so one question I have for us is, how can we speak about religious freedom to people who are otherwise not inclined to support it in language that they might understand, or meeting them in places of values that they already hold? It's a lot like evangelism, right? Meeting someone where they're at and trying to figure out how to persuade them or address their fears or concerns about a particular religion based on where they're at. And so I think that if we look at, I'm gonna use one example, legalizing pot. Let's see, this will wake you up. If we look at one example of legalizing pot, millennials tend to support the legalization of pot at about 15% rates higher than baby boomers or Gen Xers, who, interestingly, in looking this up, supported above 50% themselves. So that was an interesting statistic. But nevertheless, so if we look at the reason that perhaps a conservative versus someone who holds conservative political theory versus liberal political theory might feel differently about this. Well, I think there's two. If you hold sanctity and liberty equally, it's a much harder debate between these two competing values of something that's maybe not good for you or good for your body or good for society versus something that is freedom and liberty, the ability to kind of do what you want. But if you're someone from a liberal political ideology, you hold freedom, liberty versus oppression higher. You hold that value higher than sanctity or degradation. And so that helps explain why that may be, why if you're politically liberal, this may be a more obvious choice that the legalization of pot should be preferred over not legalizing it. So the question is, why have we not yet seen the op-ed? If you support legalizing pot, you should support religious liberty. My point being, there are ways that people are thinking about issues that are outside of this normal paradigm and these normal values that we're too often caught in talking about and thinking about that I think may offer ways forward. I think, and there will be panels later, and a lot of, you know, this conference is also focused on international religious freedom. If you, and I think using international examples is another helpful example. If we think about, again, what someone who's maybe a millennial who doesn't care about religious liberty, but again, has this high value for care and harm, right? And we think about looking at other countries where women or LGBT persons or religious minorities in theocracies are treated quite badly. And using that as an example of why in our society, right, the ability to kind of have protections for all persons, including those who are religious, and for the government not to preference a religion or to preference secularism, right, and this kind of train of thought. And so I think that there are ways for us to get out of the paradigms that we've been in. The last one I'll reference is what you all did here in Utah and President Jackson references, but fairness. I think the reason that fairness for all, and when you do poll testing, polls well, is because, again, we know that conservatives hold fairness among the six moral values equally among all six moral values, and liberals hold it more highly than loyalty, authority, or sanctity. And so trying to find a way to couch religious freedom as being fair was an effective mechanism here in Utah, and we hope will be an effective mechanism federally. Millennials also have a low appreciation for government and low appreciation for institutions, right? And so we know that liberty oppression value is held very high among progressives or political liberals. And so if we look at that, then I think we can also look at some of the ways in which we describe religious liberty. And one thing that I found is when you tell people or you point out to people that if the government is to, you know, let's use the Trinity Lutheran case, disqualify an applicant for a grant simply because they're religious, then what position does that put the government in? Well, that puts the government in the position of preferring secular institutions, which is the government then effectively establishing secularism as the state religion. And when you say that to people, actually, I found that people, again, who are kind of anti-institutional, and are like, well, we don't really trust the government, and we don't really love institutions, and we really prefer independence and autonomy and these kinds of things. When you look at it from that angle, I found that people don't have actually great responses to that, or that causes them to pause and ponder what that really would look like for the government to prefer secularism while we don't want them preferring a particular religion. Do we really want a government that prefers and has as the state religion secularism effectively? So the last comment I'll make on this, and then I'll tell you about just a couple of tactical political things we're actually doing to hopefully, because I think that the topic is that we were assigned is in the long term. And I, the reason I'm talking about this thing, these things is because these are the ways in which I think if we don't talk about religious liberty, if we don't take different tactics in the long term to preserve them, the kinds of short-term things that we're doing in the Higher Education Act and through Fairness for All and these kinds of things will in fact be short-term things because law follows culture. So how can we win over culture to caring about religious liberty who don't already? And how can we effectively educate our students, right? Religious colleges and universities have an incredible reservoir of, you know, people who are a captive audience, literally, that we can teach about religious liberty and the principles of religious liberty and why they matter in the United States. And so I think the second thing on that topic is to say, how do we separate religious freedom from partisan politics? How do we differentiate between political principles and partisan politics? Between the kinds of political principles, right? Our parties have already come and gone in the United States and will again, I think. And we'll have different names and different platforms and how it's all shuffled up. But the Constitution and the political principles of religious freedom at this particular conference that we're talking about should rise above all of that. And I hope what we actually can figure out how to do in I think among evangelical circles in particular are, again, I'm talking a lot about millennials based on the presentation yesterday and seeing that there's some significant differences that are going in the millennial generation on religion and on their views of institutions and on their views of government and on their views of these kinds of things, that if we cannot make inroads, will, I think, these things are so on the margins already, right? Our votes are 51-49, our votes are very thin, that this kind of margin, I think, and the differences we saw in the presentation yesterday will be very significant. And so among evangelical millennials, we see a deep passion for social justice, and we see a deep concern for some issues that actually have fallen more traditionally on the politically progressive or democratic or liberal side, whatever word you prefer, of the aisle. And so the question is, how can we speak to people in ways, particularly in our religious context as well, not the, all of us here are both have our professions and ways in which we're speaking to people about religious freedom, but also in our religious context, we have the opportunity to speak to people in our churches and congregations and about how they maybe should think about these issues and to differentiate between people who support politics that are on the left, but to say, and to be able to, my hope is that we have a crop of evangelical millennials who run for office as Democrats and who win and who support religious liberty and who also support, you know, universal healthcare and the carbon tax and whatever other things that are not specifically biblical or political system that fall in that partisan bucket, but to elevate our political principles above our partisan politics. So a couple of things that we're working on in Washington, D.C., which I'll just briefly talk to you about, are the Higher Education Act is being reauthorized in this Congress, hopefully. And we think there are some ways in the Higher Education Act to make some real inroads to protect faith-based colleges and universities for the long term. Patrick mentioned accreditation as a challenge, and that's been referenced by other speakers here at this conference. And my alma mater, Gordon College in New England, many of you perhaps are familiar with the challenge to their accreditation that was raised a few years ago because of their policy, which is the same as all of our other schools, that holds to traditional Christian norms around human sexuality and marriage. And their accreditation was put into scrutiny. Now I know the LDS Church was really a part of this, and we're so grateful. In 2008, in the Higher Education Act, language was added that requires accreditors to respect the religious mission of colleges and universities, but it's also very clear that that can be interpreted differently as to what that means. And I think President Jackson did a good job of referencing some of the ways in which, does that include your chapel policies? Does that include your curriculum? Does that include, or does that just kind of include the words that you literally have typed as your mission? And the implementation of mission and the policies that it pervades, I think, are a question that it, right now, is in the hands of an accreditor and how they interpret that. And we think that there's room there for Congress to give more definition to, so that Congress ultimately is the one defining that, yes, actually, that does include some of these other components of your employment and your student conduct and your retention and other kinds of policies that you have related to the actual functioning of a college campus. And so we think that there's space there for that protection to really be expanded and clarified so that it's more, more definitively protective in the future. And we also recognize that there's the enforcement mechanism is very murky. Right now, the only real enforcement mechanism is for the Secretary of Education to derecognize the accreditor. Well, that's a pretty draconian remedy and really kind of counterproductive, since it would result in the school being deaccredited in the end anyway. And so we've recognized the need for some more precise, targeted enforcement mechanisms in the Higher Education Act, which we are pursuing alongside all of our faith-based colleagues in higher education. And finally, the other effort I'll just very briefly mention is Fairness for All, which has been referenced already and that you all worked on in Utah. We are hopeful that we are exploring this, and we are hopeful that if a legislative package can be put together that meets the needs of the LGBTQ community, but also ensures protections for religious organizations and persons going forward, that is something worth exploring at the federal level, so that, as I started by saying, we can free religious freedom from the culture wars. I think I'm gonna end by saying why I think what I talked about at the beginning is so important. And that is the conversation that happened with Bernie Sanders in the hearing a couple of weeks ago for the Deputy Director of the Office of Management and Budget for the government, a pretty, I think, you know, a job that on the face of it is certainly not anything that's kind of in the culture war space. And it's a graduate, or a professor rather, at one of our institutions, Wheaton College, and had written a paper at Wheaton College when he was there articulating basic Christian doctrine around salvation. And that you belief only in Jesus Christ is, you know, otherwise is required for salvation, and stated that. And Bernie Sanders brought it up in the hearing, and I'm sure many of you read about this, and accused him of being Islamophobic because he held and had written down these very standard Christian beliefs about salvation. And I think what was very interesting in particular was that not only Bernie Sanders raised that and brought it up many times during the course of his time with the candidate or the nominee, but then the next Democratic senator who, or not the next one, but a future Democratic senator who was next to go, Senator Van Hollen, Chris Van Hollen from Maryland, he then, and as you know, Bernie Sanders is Jewish, and this senator jumped in and said, well, I'm a Christian, and this isn't what Christians believe. And so it was very confusing, I think, for one, but two, really, I think, telling about why if we don't take some different tacks and how we're trying to talk about religious freedom, the ideas are very much under attack and very, very foreign to some people. And so I think with a lot of people, we just need to start right at the very beginning about what religious freedom means, about what it means to our country, about what it means to their lives and the values that they hold, and see if we can make some inroads there. Thank you.
I'm also grateful to the organizers of this conference for bringing together a terrific group of presenters and across a range of religious convictions and opportunities. I want to title my remarks today, A Call for Courage. One thing that I've noticed as a running theme, not just through this conference or just through the things we do in our individual and professional lives, is that religion ultimately comes down to a personal conviction. And absent that, John Jackson isn't leading William Jessup the way he is. And Patrick Riley isn't leading the Cardinal Newman Society. And Shapri, a dear friend of mine, isn't coordinating across political and in a broad ecumenical way the way she is. It's because of that individual religious conviction that drives and animates what they do. And because of that, I want to give a few ideas and suggestions about how in the higher education sphere, each of you, whether you're in higher education or not, can do things that for the long term may make a real difference. And our Shapri and I have our remarks are entitled Long-Term Solutions. I think it might be a little too, maybe we can say approaches. We hope they work. I don't know if anyone has the ideal solutions, but I want to do this by talking about three basic principles, and then I'll give you two examples of how this has played out recently in ways you are not aware of, more likely than not. These are the principles that have come to mind. First is this concept of courage, the courage to take a stand. That each of you is here indicates at least some interest in religious liberty. Maybe you're here for CLE credit, and this is better than some of the alternatives. But many of you, though, are here because you're on a vacation, and this is something that matters to you. That's where a lot of this starts. That's where it starts, and that's where it really takes hold. The second is you have to work at it. This isn't going to be easy. No religious tradition that I'm aware of has as a tenet of its theology just, you know, do nothing and it will all come to you easily. There's some aspect of reaching out or serving or of congregating or of being willing to withstand the fiery darts that come at you from any number of angles. And the third is this, and this is my own personal approach, and it's rooted somewhat in my own theology that I believe in, but I've seen it across many religious traditions, and that is connecting human being to human being. As I believe, brother and sister to brother and sister is the only way that we get through this. Connecting with like-minded and with people who are opposed to us. So instead of just having, you know, a religious liberty conference, I love the conferences when I'm in a room with very few religious people whom I've learned to love and respect for their convictions. Many of the attorneys that I work with were drawn to the law because of civil rights law, social justice in the 60s and 70s, and then currently now the LGBTQ rights is a great opportunity for many people to come into law, and I interact with them and I love their passion, their conviction. And as I respond to and learn about what draws them to their career, and then as they get to know me and learn what drew me to my career, there's a mutual understanding that creates this room for pluralism we've heard about, creates a room for the concept of institutions. The religious institution that so many millennials disregard or that much of society disregards is interesting because you turn it around and say, well, what institutions matter to you? And the right to gather that Alexander Dushku talked about yesterday turns out to be integral to many of these other situations of any social justice group saying, oh, we want to have our group because this is what we care about. And that, along the lines Shapri just talked about, then helps them understand how a religious institution can be something other than just a hierarchical or only a top-down approach. It is, at heart, a group of brothers and sisters of similar convictions. So let me now tell you the two stories. The two people I'll talk about are people I've never met in person. I don't think one of them sent me an email, so one of them might remember my name. The other one has no idea who I am. So let me start with the first one. His name is Skip Lupia. He is a professor of political science at Michigan. He was at conferences going back decades with one of our political scientists here at BYU. They would present, they got to know each other well. Skip has, to my knowledge, no religious convictions, but he's a very open and loving and good person. He's an excellent political scientist. So one of the political scientists in our department began to work with him in conferences, and they began to cross-pollinate. And some of the excellent work that was being done here on campus, they started to produce papers together. As some of the graduates of BYU went to political science graduate degrees in the University of Michigan, they then went to work for Skip. Skip realized that a lot of these graduates were extraordinarily hardworking, very thoughtful, very dedicated. And it was interesting because over that time, especially when the recent cultural wars started to heat up even more, here's someone who has no ties to the Mormon church. He has no ties really to BYU other than through some professional collaborations. But he began to see these issues through another lens because of the human connection of a colleague. And these are some of the quotes that I took from my colleague, from my friend here at BYU. He said, and they've also done, it's interesting because all of this information is now backed up by their social science through political science surveys and other research on how humans interact and how institutions can make lasting changes. He says, suspicions die down when people get to know us well. And how do you get to know somebody well? You invite them to your house. More importantly, you go to their house. You find out what matters to them, and they find out what matters to you, and suddenly, now you're human beings, and it's much harder to take a hardline stance and say, everybody in that category is evil or bad or wrong, because you now have a human being that you put in that category that you know and love and respect. And the people, this is now Skip talking to my friend, but people who really get to know Mormons or any other group become resistant to the negative information about them. So think about that. Think about how in our increasingly plural society, even as we have communities of faith that are important, and for me, crucially important, the interrelationships among religious institutions like we have, but also among the secular institutions, creates an opportunity for people to become our advocates for religious principles who don't have a personal stake in the game, other than they now know you and they care about you. Now, here's the caveat. In this political science area, so it worked out this way. The professors here began inviting other professors across the nation to come to workshop papers. A lot of the professors thought, I don't want to go to BYU. You know, isn't that some religious school? Or maybe they have some crazy beliefs. I don't know what's going on. The workshopping, though, in this academic exercise was top notch. All the political science professors took it really seriously. They would take the other paper, they would vet it, and it became known as one of the most intensive and preparatory processes for these papers to become approved and then landed in the best journals. And over time, we now have dozens of people who are clamoring to be a part of this really good workshopping process. That then allows people to come to BYU and see, oh, these are people a lot like you and I are. And then when they go and they're in their other conferences and someone says something generally bad about a Mormon or generally bad about religion, a lot of times, and Skip included, will stand up and say, you know, that's not been my experience, and point to actual examples of it. Now, notwithstanding all of that and the quality of the work being excellent, we have to be continually prepared for the bias that will continue to exist. I don't know of any religious tradition that doesn't believe in a continuing some sort of opposition against that faith process of this mortal experience. So that's example number one in our political science department. Example number two goes directly to the accreditation issues we've been talking about. I think this is probably the most crucial battleground for religious diversity in higher education. And it's something I think that as religious leaders and as institutional leaders at higher education, we need to get a grasp on how to recruit and strategize for people in all professions, including in, you know, public school teachers to academics in all the disciplines, people of religious conviction to be in the governing boards of those areas and bring their excellent work with their personal conviction so that the decisions those accrediting bodies make are made in a way that ultimately protects religious liberty. So the other person is named Bill Hathaway. He's a psychologist at Regent University. I never met him. I was aware of him because BYU has three psych programs. All are accredited by the APA, the American Psychological Association. We have a clinical psych program, a counseling psych program, and a school psychology program. Over the years, it's happened in the 90s, it happened again in 2009, it happened most recently in 2014, there were efforts by the accrediting group to change their accrediting principles or their guidelines. In the APA, their master document is called Guidelines and Principles. Within that are these standards of accreditation, and they have a whole bunch of domains. It's the kind of thing that makes even lawyers' eyes kind of glaze over. So it's, you know, buried into it. But in those regulations includes a bunch of non-discrimination principles. And as non-discrimination principles were added to protect, in addition to race and religion and sex, also to include sexual orientation or gender identity, there was this uneasy tension among the psychologists about, well, what do you do about those faith-based schools that have conduct codes? The APA had worked out kind of a detente with what was called footnote 4. And footnote 4 allowed specifically for religious institutions to have accredited programs provided they did two things. One was a notice component. In all your hiring or in all your recruiting, you had to let people know what you were about. And that's fair. That ended up being the compromise of SB 1146 in California. That's been an accreditation principle for decades. It's also an opportunity for religious institutions to really own their religious missions. I mean, at the heart of it, I know this for BYU, but I'm convinced it's for everybody too. We're not here in spite of the religious piece. I personally am here because of the religious piece. That's what animates it. And Bill Hathaway is a psychologist because of, not in spite of, his religious conviction. He sees youth and young adults, and in his research, he sees individuals for whom religious convictions are key and for which psychology has a lot of times denigrated. And he has spent his career trying to protect that space. So we met with our dean or our chairs of each of those three departments at BYU, and we strategized, how are we going to go about influencing this accreditation process? And one thing I did was I went through all of the lists of all the schools that were accredited. You know, there are hundreds of accredited schools, narrowed down to ones that had religious backgrounds or maybe religious histories. We sent out letters and said, are you interested in being a part of it? It turned out that of all of those schools, fewer than a dozen had ever publicly invoked footnote 4. Basically been willing to say, institutionally, we're one of those schools. We're a school that takes its religious conviction seriously enough that we have both a conduct code, or we're willing to take heat on how we run our program based on our religious convictions. Among those schools, we were able to get a coalition of them to write a letter to the Committee on Accreditation. I did a lot of legal work about all the nuances of it. One thing, I know many of you are familiar with the New Testament. I love in Matthew 10, and this is now Christ teaching his 12 apostles, but he asked them, he basically says, you need to be wise as serpents, but harmless as doves. So as a lawyer, there's Book of Mormon precedent for the lawyers being, you know, tricky guys that will twist things. In fact, we have a Mormon prophet that is quoted to me often, who is, you know, talks to the lawyer and says, oh, thou child of hell. And that, it's right there in the Book of Mormon. I can't deny it. But notwithstanding all of that, it is not inappropriate to use stratagem or strategy. Stratagem is another Book of Mormon word I love. It is one of the things that in this accreditation process that had happened is I dug down and realized that they had made a public statement saying, we're going to change footnote 4. We're going to bring it up into the main text of the standards. And then I read the text, and curiously, three components were missing. One was the idea of adhering to a religion, not just stating that you are a part of a religion. Adherence is important. That goes to conduct codes. Another part was about not just employing someone, but retaining their employment based on religious convictions, which again is important. For a community of faith to be able to determine the contours of its faith is crucial. And for religious institutions, that's crucial. And then another one was that there would be First Amendment protections of the Constitution. So in our comment that we wrote back, we wrote it very diplomatically and very kindly, but just said, you know, you might have, you know, just missed this. It might be an oversight. But as you put that up in the main text, you just happen to miss these words, and we'll just show you where they are and why you put them up in the main text. We thought that was kind of clever. In the end, that wasn't what made the difference. What made the difference was this. Bill Hathaway was on the Committee on Accreditation. He sat down with a group of his peers, all in this committee, some of whom are LGBTQ individuals, who talked about the harm and the hurt they have felt in their lives about being rejected. He also was able to explain his own personal convictions about how religion mattered to him personally and professionally. And in the end, in that closed door meeting in which Bill was unable to actually give us details about, all we saw at the end was the result. And the result was the same detente still exists in psychology. There's room for religious institutions, but it was because of the personal courage of a psychologist, of his own personal faith, and to say, I'm at a school, he's at Regent University, that takes this seriously too. And there's a place for Regent University in the pantheon of psychology programs across America. So let me conclude with this. One of my favorite scriptures comes from Micah. And he distills for me what I believe in the gospel, which is, what does the Lord require of us but to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy Lord? All of those things, I think, come together when we take the courage to take a personal and professional and institutional stance on religious liberty. When we put the work that is required into it, we can't be sloppy or shoddy. We have to be the best at what we're doing in any of these academic fields in higher education or in any other profession we're in. And then third, the walking humbly part for me is to follow Christ's example. And he went among the people who were outcast and despised. And when we do that too, we will find that people will reach out to us when we're likewise similarly situated. We don't know which side on the road to Jericho we'll be in as we move along in our life's journeys. And I hope to be both an opportunity to help out those that need it, and I would be very, very grateful and continue to be grateful for the outreach that we receive here at BYU and that the church receives from not just like-minded people, but from people who oppose what we stand for, but also appreciate us as human beings and are grateful for our reach to them. And I'm grateful again for your time.
Okay, we have about 20 minutes for questions. I'm going to stand so I can see the whole room. What I'd like to do is take two or three questions at a time and then give them to our panelists, the gentleman in the red shirt. Please wait for the microphone so it will get picked up on our recording.
Does BYU belong to CCCU?
No, we don't. And I'm actually really grateful that the CCCU has the ability and defines its contours in ways that says this is what it means to be a member of the CCCU. I feel fully loved and appreciated by the CCCU. But this is another thing. I don't think the CCCU, for example, the contours of the Mormon doctrine and belief doesn't say, you know, we also include all Catholics and all evangelicals. And that's precisely, I think, the beauty of the religious diversity that we preserve as we work together.
Yes, the woman in the white shirt.
I appreciate the conversation about seeing that there are multiple ways of approaching these things and listening to both sides. My personal reflection on what I've heard this morning has to do with the instance of, you know, feeling persecuted in ways. For instance, my son in school was able to talk about his baptism. And I know that the law is still on the side of the student to be able to express themselves that way. But he was also beaten up every day by his Mormon classmates because he was gay. So it is my deeply held religious beliefs that inspire me and lead me to advocate for a safe world for him and everyone, not only to share their baptism story, but also to be safe and to be safe throughout their life. And I think one of the most difficult things is when we have any conversation that says, here's religious conviction and there's the LGBT community, and not recognize that in among us all, we are all here. Nearly every LGBTQ person I know is deeply religious, deeply spiritual, and also wanting to be a part of the community that they choose and feel led to be. And so this is a complex conversation. And my concern is, how can we move beyond the us and them conversation? That the reason our religious conversation is changing because of them, but instead move to, this is all us, all of us. All of us are LGBTQ. All of us are seeking to express our religious conviction. All of us are following our biblical belief. All of us have these concerns. How is it that we can move into the conversation of truly hearing each other's story and finding a way to see how we're truly and deeply connected in these concerns, instead of seeing it is more divisive because it's us versus them? Because in my personal experience, I am seeing those conversations literally killing people. And the law continues to be on the side of those of us who seek to express our religious belief. The law has never truly and securely been on the side of those who don't fit into our conversation of what biblical life is meant to be. And that's my concern, because my religious deeply held belief as an LDS person is to have room for everybody to find their path in whatever way is truly and deeply held, and to do it safely and with love as we care for each other. And I'm seeing wonderful conversation about how we can listen to each other, but I continue to see a very divisive conversation. And that's my concern, is how can we move beyond that?
Okay, I think that's such an important question. Why don't we give our panelists an opportunity to respond?
I would love to first of all say thank you for your personal courage in sharing your story today. I've had opportunity on many, many, many occasions to be in relationship with persons from the LGBTQ community. I meet on a fairly regular basis in downtown Sacramento with the Leaders of Equality California, which would be the group that would oppose much of what I've advocated for. I want you to know that in those contexts, I've actually apologized with tears at the way people have been treated by people in the name of Christ. I've asked for forgiveness. I've also talked about the fact that the scripture teaches clearly that every human being is made in the image of God and therefore is precious in his sight, and that the gospel commands me to love and to care for each individual person. So any kind of social structure that follows from the gospel, in my view, must be redemptive. So if you've heard anything in me today that is not redemptive, I ask for your forgiveness. That's not my intent whatsoever. I do think, however, that as somebody said, the law follows culture. I agree with that. But culture follows values and principles. And I do think we have to decide, is it possible for us to have values that dignify each and every individual human being as worthy and as made in the image of God, while at the same time having a framework that talks about maleness and femaleness and sexuality in the context of what I understand scripture to be. And I know that's a very, very challenging assignment, but it should be done redemptively and lovingly and should never involve anything that diminishes the personhood of individuals. So thank you for your courage.
Is there anyone else on the panel who'd like to respond, Shapri, or?
Just invite you to come to our panel this afternoon.
Yeah.
And I'll add that, I think that's what was so encouraging about what Utah did, was that it recognized that there are religious people who have jobs and are LGBT and need housing and kind of the basic access to areas of public space, that other legal questions and other legal cases have asked kind of some of the moral questions. Lawrence v. Texas in 2003, right, said that in Texas at that time, what they called sodomy was illegal still, right? And that said that was not okay. Obergefell in 2015, right, changed the law on marriage. But what I hear you talking about is kind of apart from moral space, this area of, and religious space, this kind of just common space that's housing, employment, and recognition of kind of all of our humanity and need for kind of these basic areas of space to be accessed by all persons, including LGBT persons of faith. And so I think that that's an encouraging step, what Utah did, and something that, you know, if if it's possible to pull it off at the federal level, there's many obstacles, but if it's possible, I think it hopefully kind of bring the detente that Steve referenced, and also create space for the kinds of theological convictions in those institutions and spaces to remain, like President Jackson has referenced, but also in kind of areas of shared space for there to be legal protection for everyone.
I think the question that's focusing on the word safety is really insightful, because there's so much fear and so much concern about safety on both sides of these issues. There's a fear and a history of experiencing real discrimination by many people who are religious minorities, and also those who are sexual minorities. If you look around the world, one of the things that's interesting, in the United States, we really tend to frame this as a contest between discrimination and religious freedom. But if you look around the world and see who is suffering the pains of discrimination, it's often religious people. I mean, who we see among others being persecuted and killed based on their identity, it's often religious people. But it's often also sexual minorities. And so I think the effort to try to find ways of protecting each other in our particularity and in our complexity, I think it's really important to realize that people are not just religious or not just gay. There are a lot of people who are religious and gay and want to find ways to live within their communities in ways that they can be whole and loved. Other questions? Yes. Please wait for the microphone.
Just one thought that came to my mind, President Jackson, when you were talking about biblical views on these areas, and I would tend to be in agreement. I think we could be in agreement on most of those areas. But when you said that you would not support any legislation that would change any of that, even if it protected possibly religious liberties, I'm just wondering, is that just taking a stance that is immovable and intractable? And just like to hear some further comments on that, maybe from you and from other panelists.
Yeah, so the question, what can we compromise about?
Sure. So again, I'm no lawyer, I'll remind you of that multiple times, but it seems to me that in the Utah legislation that was passed, it was exceedingly helpful to provide very clear civil protections for employment and housing. And I absolutely celebrate that. I think I honored that in my comments, that I completely agree with providing civil protections. I think the word safety is an important word to utilize. In that Utah legislation, if I recall correctly, there was not an address of public accommodation kind of issues, and then the broader questions that we're seeing now making their way to the Supreme Court. Does the baker, the florist, the photographer have ability to exercise their, what they describe as artistic freedom in alignment with their religious convictions? So my comment to you would be, I want a safe, civil, pluralistic, constitutional republic. And I think that's possible. And I think a safe, civil, I forgot the third one I said, constitutional.
Pluralistic,
thank you. Constitutional republic is very doable. And it's doable in such a way that we honor religious freedom. I think we've done that before in our history. My concern, and I know I'm going to raise some hackles here, but it's almost lunchtime. It'll be good for your digestion. I know this is a buzzword. I worry about what is labeled the progressive agenda, because I often believe, and by the way, I'm not speaking here of universal health care or environmental concerns. I think that what is often described as the progressive agenda is really a regressive agenda. If there is no place where we can declare anything that is absolute in terms of truth, then I'm concerned for the republic. I don't know that you can have a constitutional republic if we don't agree on what the meaning of the word is. Sorry for being mildly political at that point. I do believe that ultimately, if we want to have a constitutional republic, we have to have a commitment to what the meaning of the Constitution is. And I, of course, would be more inclined to be an originalist, to suggest that the meanings in the Constitution are important for us to at least understand and discuss. So I think it's highly possible. I think we're going to have to work hard at it. I appreciate what Shapri and Steve and others like them are equipped to do that I'm not equipped to do. I can't discuss the more finer points of law and rulemaking and regulation, but I do know the principles are really important, but we can be safe, civil, pluralistic, and constitutional.
Patrick, do you have something to add on this question of what is something to be compromised and what's not to be compromised?
Well, I think part of what needs to be added to this conversation is we're at a conference on religious freedom, but ultimately, religious freedom is not the final, is not the end. If we live in a country that takes away our religious freedom, it doesn't take away the truth, and it doesn't take away religion. It doesn't take away our faith. And that's the most important thing. And I do worry about, in many of these conversations or many of these compromises, this attempt to preserve religious institutions, to preserve our religious freedom, which is something that we need to fight for as far as we can. But if it goes so far that we're willing to compromise basic human anthropology, that we're willing to change the structure of society to say that no longer is the foundation of society man marries woman, father and mother raise child. If we're willing to completely change our understanding of human anthropology, then I think that that's going too far. I think that that's denying basic truth, and I think it's denying the basic needs that people have. And I understand that there's a disagreement about that, but that's what we're facing. And I do worry that when you start to put these, even when you talk about, I mean, some of the language that's been used in this conference, sexual minorities, LGBT, sexual orientation, I mean, these are words that, at least from a Catholic standpoint, and I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous because I know this is a very touchy issue for a lot of people. Those are terms that frankly don't gel with our understanding of the human person. They're simply incorrect. And so, and the whole gender movement, it's simply incorrect from a Catholic point of view. And it's not just, these are not just disagreements about mysteries of faith, okay, where we all have different understandings of God and mysteries of God, and we try to come to a real genuine understanding of God, you know, about the Trinity or all these different things that you know, religions will disagree about and try to work out. I mean, these are basic understandings of human society, of the human person. And we need to keep that in mind, at least, you know, to realize that at some point we cannot compromise on those things. And that's not being intractable. That's recognizing basic truth that's fundamental to our society.
Shapri or Stephen, did you have anything you'd like to add?
I just wanted to mention too that, especially with the comment from the mother of her son, there is, I think, a growing awareness among religious traditions about ways to identify and also things, personal life experiences that are real. And that's, as part of this overall understanding, that's happening within religious congregations. It's threatening to provide schisms for some that might actually tear their groups apart. You'll read about those in the news. But among the faith traditions, all of them are going through these issues about what does doctrine mean? How does it play out among its adherents? The thing I wanted to most focus on, though, is in the higher education space and in our societal space, too, there are people who completely disagree with my own viewpoint or Patrick's or others. And that's the republic that I want to continue to be a part of and help shape that discussion. And that's where the reaching out and being willing to live in a society. And I'm personally hoping to be able to find ways, legislatively or otherwise, where the rights and deeply held convictions of all people, including LGBTQ individuals and their organizations, to feel the same safety and dignity that I hope they will accord to me. And that's the common ground space that's exceedingly difficult to find. It really is, because sometimes people's viewpoints, the Venn diagrams, don't overlap. But hopefully you can find some places where they do, and at least agree to live peaceably among each other
and respect at heart their right to disagree too. That's again, part of what I think makes America an amazing place.
And I'll just add that I think the bases by which we are looking at a number of different ways in which to preserve religious liberty is so that we can ensure that not only as individuals, but as institutions, there can be places where there's the legitimacy of the institutions to kind of actually hold these contrary views about gender and so that society, you know, doesn't no longer regards, and to hold them in the sorts of legitimate ways that allow us to speak into the academy, into journals, into the public square through institutions. And that, I agree with what you said, may not always be able to be preserved. And that's not like, nobody here, I don't think, is worried that our faith will not go on if these things don't exist. The Lord is bigger than all of this. But I think that we're seeking to preserve our ability not only to hold these beliefs as individuals, but in institutions in the kinds of ways that allow us actually to be a minority voice, to offer a contrary view that is perhaps the best hope at persuading society back in the direction that there is some merit and some value to some of the beliefs that we hold that are currently not in vogue.
Thank you. I think Patrick said something really important. Religious freedom is not the most important thing. None of us want to join the Church of Religious Freedom. Religious freedom is not going to bring us salvation. It's not going to bring us happiness. It's not going to be a truth that will give us purpose or meaning in our life. We may find those things through the space that religious freedom gives us. So when Bruce R. McConkie, in the quote that I used yesterday, talked about how basic religious freedom is, it's not to say that it's the most important thing. From a Christian perspective, I think the atonement of Jesus Christ is the most important thing. But what religious freedom does is it gives us as human beings the opportunity to follow our conscience and to be drawn towards truth and to search for and seek truth, to seek love, to seek happiness, to seek meaning, to seek enlightenment. And the term I like to use from a legal perspective is the idea of constitutional space, that what religious freedom, among other freedoms, does is it gives us a space where we can seek to live our lives. And so it's not just or even primarily a moral principle, it's a political principle. It helps us have a way of living together where we can each be human and each be whole, as we heard this morning. But I'm grateful to each of our panelists for helping us think about these issues. We don't come together expecting to agree with everything that each other says. I think extent of our agreement is remarkable, but the existence of disagreement is also important. And we're grateful for our ability to speak and to disagree with each other, but to also do that in the right ways. So please join me in thanking our panel, and then we'll be dismissed for lunch.